Chuck Shaden with you on our Nostalgia Night on Old Time Radio from WBBM News Radio 78. It's an evening we've been looking forward to for a long time because it gives us an opportunity to introduce to you a gentleman who had a very important part in the golden age of radio, though he must have started when he was just a young boy because he does not seem to be all that old, like me, with the long gray beard and the gray hair and walking with a cane and all of that sort of thing. But we have Paul Renard, who is the proprietor, the owner, and creator of Music Dynamics, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But, Paul, you were an organist and a pianist in New York City during those great days, weren't you?
That's right, but you think I am a lot older than you think. Let's say I'll take credit for maybe 55. Anything beyond that is anybody's guess. But I only had a shorter career than most people. I wasn't in it, 25, 30 years like Jesse Crawford or Rosario or Lou White. I had probably a good 10 to 12 years. I've had 22 years with between local radio and network radio, but only really about maybe 10 to 12 of the networks.
Well, how did you get your start in radio? What brought you to become a Kilocycle Kid?
Well, you mean local, which was your start with, or network?
Well, all right, let's locally you can start with.
We lived, my dad was a theater manager, and we lived in Millville, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a station nearby that was called WSNJ. It was a 1240 on the dial, 250-watt station, just about close enough that my family could hear it when I was on it. Mm-hmm. And I said to my dad one day, I want to try radio as a pianist. I was, at the time, only about 11 or 12 years old. And he said, you're not going. And I said, yes, I am. Mm-hmm. And I took the bus very audaciously on my own and went over to WSNJ, asked for an audition, got my own show, which I had for 2.5 years.
At 12 years old?
Yes, it was called Sweetheart Time. And we went from there to a thing called Paul Renard's Musical Scrapbook, where I told a lot about the lives of the different composers, whether it was Sigmund Romberg, Jerome Kern, what have you, and then I would play their music. I went from WSNJ to WWBZ in Vineland, New Jersey, which is 1,000-watt. You know, you grow with this thing. And the next thing I knew, I had a show there, Paul Renard's Piano Reveries. And then along with that, I was accompanying on a thing called the Star Maker Show, which came from the Stanley Theater, remote, in Vineland. And I discovered that I was a pretty good accompanist by the time I was 14 and a half years old. So I think you start with this stuff very, very early, really.
Well, I would say that's a very early start indeed.
Yes.
Well, now, you worked for all four of the radio networks, NBC, CBS, ABC,
and Mutual.
And Mutual.
Yeah.
Now, was it ABC or was it the Red and Blue Network?
It was actually Red and Blue were together. Mm-hmm. The best way to describe it is when you were at Rockefeller Center, if you didn't know, you had to get assignment. You could walk in and play the wrong show. Because until ABC split and moved up to 66th Street, when they had their own place, I know the first times that I even went into the studios with Rosa Rio, who was my mentor, Rosa said to me, she says, if I go in the wrong room, I'll be playing the wrong show. You never knew what show was going on. So ABC and NBC were very closely coordinated between Bob Aaron, NBC's music coordinator, and Frank Vagnoni, which was ABC's. And they were constantly working to make sure that you knew where you were going. Mm-hmm. But it was a maze for many years until they split.
Well, did you know, in Chicago, Chicago radio in the old days, and I've talked with an awful lot of actors in Chicago radio, and they were, everybody was freelance, and they worked for CBS in the Wrigley Building, WBBM studios, for NBC, which was in the merchandise market, and WGM Mutual, which was in the Tribune Tower, and they would go from one building to the next, sometimes they had to worry about the Michigan Avenue Bridge.
The Bridge Club. Do you know that Bridge Club story?
The Bridge Up Club, of course.
Sure.
Of course, that became a convenient excuse for being late, too, at any good given time. Did you ever have much trouble getting from one venue to another while you were working?
The best way to describe it, you call this conflict time. That was the term in New York. You could have a conflict. I know of actors who would have terrible conflicts and would have nightmares that they wouldn't make them and make it within seconds.
Mm-hmm.
At NBC, they had a different way of doing that. If you had two shows close, they'd have an elevator waiting for you, and that elevator would be there, and you would walk in, they would whisk you down, you'd get to the next studio. And if you were smart, you didn't have your shows too close. There's a story about that. Bill Meter had two soap operas. One was called Pepper Young's Family, which followed by Right to Happiness, and he did both shows, which was nervy. And what happened was they were across from each other. One came from, I think it was 3D, and the other one came from 3F. because they, all the soap shows were on 3 and on 8 at NBC. And Bill would finish one show, and they would open the... first of all, he had to turn the organ on in both studios to be ready to go and have the stops and the drawbars and everything set up. And he would do one show, and as they were saying, this is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company, he would be... the pages would hold two doors open. He'd go right into the next room, and then he'd sit down and be ready to do that next theme. And I always was waiting for the day, because the floors were always slippery when he would get down. It was everybody knew the mad dash, and nobody at that moment tried to go past there while he was going through.
Ready to go. Well, now, how many shows were you working at a given time?
Well, I would say probably... And this I should explain. I did a tremendous amount of substituting. Mm-hmm. It became a career because, of course, I was doing a lot of teaching. I was on Riverside Records staff cutting records. I was doing things for Columbia. Mm-hmm. I was busy all over the place. So my biggest fun there was subbing because everybody needed a sub. Now, there's a story behind this. Rosa Rio was another great sub. She'd do about 30 shows a week and another 30 shows for everybody else. And she said to me in that wonderful southern dialect of hers one day, she says, honey, there's one thing you got to know. This is a small business. There's not a lot of people doing it. And everybody's afraid of losing their shows. And they know with Rosa, when I do their show, when they come back, that show is there. And they don't have to worry about competition. She said, that's how you do this. She said, you start subbing. She said, and let people find out that their job's going to be there and you're going to be busier than anybody else. And I wound up subbing for everybody in the business, which means I can tell you about more shows. I can tell you the names of any organist that did any show, and I'll be absolutely out on the money with it, because I subbed from at one point or another.
Well, can you name some of the programs on which you you played the organ?
Yeah, I did Inner Sanctum for Lou White one time. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Rosa had a funny thing happen. She lives up in the country in Shelton, Connecticut, and she lives in a house, a cave, literally by a waterfall. And they used to get flooded constantly. Whenever Rosa would get flooded, she would call me, do my shows. Well, that was, you're talking about My True Story, Ted Malone, When a Girl Marries, all the things that had moved over to ABC. And so I would get a shot at every one of those. I was Herb Schreiner's organist on some of the things that he did. In fact, I was horrified when he had that accident with Pixie and they were killed. He and I were good friends. He was a man who loved the organ. In fact, he had a pipe organ in his home. Most people don't know that. So did Arthur Lake, Dagwood, by the way. There's a number of people that had those. But Herb loved organ. And so I wound up doing the organ for his Two for the Money, and then I wound up being able to do his Herb Schreiner show for Geritol, which was very short-lived. And by the way, was directed by Alan Sherman, my son, the folk singer.
My son, the folks.
Yeah.
Hello, Mama. Hello.
Right, exactly.
Daughter, hello, Father.
He was the director of that show, and also Gary Moore's I've Got a Secret. I think he even owned a piece of that. But he was our director on that.
Tell me, Paul, since you were there, can you describe the NBC studios? Which actually, I would think NBC in New York was the epitome of the golden age of radio. With all due respect to CBS, which is also the epitome of the golden age of radio.
Oh,
NBC... At Rockefeller Center.
Right.
What kind of radio facilities did they have there?
Magnificent. Mm-hmm. First of all, they had the third floor and the eighth floor, which were everything that was basically soap opera. And Mary Margaret McBride, of course, came from there, too. Talk shows would be there. Of course, 8H was the big monster studio, and I used to hide in there whenever I could and back and watch Toscanini rehearse the NBC Symphony and learned an awful lot about good timing in my music, just watching that man do that. But that was the biggest studio on 8. Everything else was small. When a Girl Marries came from there, Pepper Young's Family was third floor. See, and so 3 and 8 were the soap opera floors. Mm-hmm. 2, they had some studios. Bob Smith used to do his morning show on 2. And the 6...
You're talking about Buffalo Bob.
Buffalo
Smith,
Bob,
right?
Yeah, started out for Men, Shave.
Mm-hmm.
The 6th floor was not soap. Although, the 6th floor was the big shows. Henry Aldrich was on that floor. Mm-hmm. I was... when Bob Hastings talked, I heard him talking with you about being in 6. He was. Mm-hmm. Aldrich and Archie Andrews came from across studios. Mm-hmm. There was just A and there was B. D was a studio I was in and worked with Ed Herlihy on a show called Junior Reporter. One of the oddest shaped rooms I've ever been in my life. But that room was used for smaller shows.
Mm-hmm.
A and B were the monster studios, or the bigger studios, not like 8H. And, of course, they were later were the first to be converted to TV.
Mm-hmm.
Milton Berle came from A, and Henry Aldridge stayed in B for a long, long time. But, in fact, when I first met Rosa Rio, I was doing this show. I was a kid on a show with Ed Herlihy called Junior Reporter for NBC, which was local. And I had one dream. I always wanted to meet my heroine, Rosa Rio, who's been my friend to this day. And one day when we were rehearsing during the week for the show, which was, I think, Thursday night, we were there in the morning. I got off of school for that. And I simply, Rosa was in the big room. They were doing My True Story from there. Normally they'd use a smaller room, but occasionally you'd find them using a big theater. And I just walked in there. I went from D to A, and I introduced myself to Rosa, and we've been friends now for a billion years since.
Those studios you were discussing, they were, the bigger studios were audience studios.
Yes.
The public would
come yes. In. Archie Andrews came from A. Can You Top This came from A. See, I'm thinking, they use those studios the way CBS used the theaters, the 54 and such, and Mutual used Longacre and that sort of thing. Everybody had well, NBC never had outside stuff. They later had the Center Theater, where Tallulah Bankhead came from when the ice shows left. But primarily, the outside theaters were strictly the domain of CBS and Mutual. ABC even then didn't have things like they had the Élysée years later. And where I think I Got a Secret used to come from. But those theaters were never an NBC thing. NBC had so much space, they never needed outside theaters.
I mean, great in Rockefeller.
Sure.
Our guest is Paul Renard. He's a man who was there, and we thought you'd like to hear about some of the things that happened in those days. And we're going to talk more with Paul. We've also got some comedy with Bud Abbott and Lou Costello coming up in just a little bit. I'm Chuck Shaden. You're listening to Old Time Radio from Chicago. This is Nostalgia Night on WBBM News Radio 78. Who's on first? I don't know. He's on third. No, that's a different routine. Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, a little mustard at the old ballpark. Chuck Shaden here with you on Nostalgia Night from WBBM News Radio 78. Our guest is Paul Renard. He was an organist in New York City during those great golden days of radio. And, Paul, you were describing the NBC studios.
Uh-huh.
I want to give equal time to the Columbia Broadcasting System. Now, they
under
were
the
not...
circumstances, could we do otherwise?
We would do it anyway, but Where was CBS in relation to NBC?
Well, it was not where it is today. It was at 485 Madison Avenue. Mm-hmm. But everyone has a misconception. They think that everything was at 485, which was not true.
Mm-hmm.
Across the street, there was a much shorter building. Was probably maybe three or four stories, maybe five. That I forget. And you had studios 21 to 28. Arthur Godfrey, in the morning, was in studio 22 down in the basement. Mm-hmm. That was there. That was also Herb Shriner's Two for the Money studio.
Oh, uh-huh.
But upstairs from 21 through 27 was Helen Trent, Ma Perkins, Nona Drake, Nordrake. It was The Brighter Day. All the soap shows came from this short building. The tall building, which for 485, of course, had master control at one point, all the offices, and one floor, I think it was the 22nd floor, that had two studios. And Jenny was in one on the left, and Big Sister was in the other one. And the one that had Big Sister also was Perry Mason. That's it. It was Perry Mason, Big Sister.
People don't realize that Perry Mason was a soap opera, was a daytime drama long before...
Sure, John Larkin and Joan Alexander.
That's right. Raymond Burr became Perry Mason on television. But Joan Alexander, too, was at one time was Lois Lane on Superman.
Yes, she was with Bud Collier. I don't know if you know anything about her. Joan Alexander was also a panelist on many shows, too. I loved that girl. I just absolutely loved her. She had the sharpest tongue. You know, when she talked, she had a sharp sound. Even if she said hello, she sounded like she might be telling you off. But she was a sharp lady.
Mm-hmm.
She was an elegant lady. And she had a voice and a manner about her that was like nobody else. She could play the hotsy-totsy babe. And she played Molls, too, just like Elspeth Eric did. Probably better than anybody I ever saw. But she was very, very involved. She was, well, she, of course, was with John Larkin. She played Della Street on that show. On Perry Mason. And, oh gosh, she was a fixture for so many years. In fact, John Larkin, did you know, was married to Terry Keane, who was, she did Life Can Be Beautiful when Les Tremaine and Alice Reinhart went out to California. You know, you see Les Tremaine in so many movies?
Yes.
They made a big move, and Terry came right in, and she was Chi-Chi on Life Can Be Beautiful for many, many years.
Papa David and
Ralph Lock,
slightly used bookstore.
That's right.
That was the setting for Life Can Be Beautiful.
That show had a nickname. It was called LCBB.
The initials.
The initials, yeah.
LCBB. They thought it was LCBB.
Uh-huh.
Hello, BB. Well, now, back to CBS. The studios there, the audience studios, for example, what were they all... at 485, or were they?
No.
They were, you said before they were in theaters around.
Yeah, Studio 54, which became a disco, was a place that had a Let's Pretend. It became the Ed Sullivan Theater. Mm-hmm. Arthur Godfrey had the Talent Scouts, the Arthur Godfrey and His Friends show there. Jackie Gleason practically owned that theater. And that was one of their theaters, and I think they had several others, but that was the most prominent. It Pays to Be Ignorant came from that theater. Almost every major show at one point, and of course when it went television, it was also television. Now, as I said, Herb was there and Jackie Gleason. It started out a radio theater, and then went from there to being a television theater, and was very well suited to both.
Do you know if that was the same theater where Orson Welles was doing his Mercury Theaters, Mercury Players things?
I don't know. There you've got me on that, because that was way before
much
me.
Much earlier, yeah.
Much earlier, into the 30s when I was still a kid.
Mm-hmm. You were only working at age 11. You didn't.
True, but I wasn't in New York at the time. I was from New York, but it wasn't there at that point.
Well, how do ABC or rather Mutual Studios compare to CBS?
They were at 1440 Broadway. They were small. I filled in one time for the organist on Superman, which was Mutual. It was a small studio. Mel Bailey, who directed I Love a Mystery, had it at Mutual. That was a small studio. All the studios there were small. There might have been somebody's might hear this and say, "Hey, you've forgotten we had a couple of large ones." No, they used the Longacre Theater. And they had one other theater, which I can't remember now. Longacre had The Shadow. It had Sherlock Holmes. It had Bulldog. No, I think Bulldog Drummond at one point was there, and it was an audience show. But I remember Sherlock Holmes and The Shadow always coming from the Longacre. And I'm sure you do, because you play the shows, and you hear them saying from the Longacre
Theater. Yes, and you always hear applause at the end. It's amazing how they kept that audience so still through those programs. And yet there's big enthusiastic applause and cheers at the end of it. I can't imagine how they never got a cough out of that audience, even, you know.
Well, I have a feeling that what they did really was, I know most of the audiences were mic'd, but I have a feeling the mics were off. And in those days, they weren't as sensitive as this one I'm talking into. They didn't pick it up. I think they had to work a little harder in the 30s and 40s and early 50s really to probably pick that up, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, John Stone and Orson Welles and Brett Morrison, who played the Shadow, all worked in a little booth doing the Shadow voice into a carbon mic. Did you know that's how they got the Shadow sound? He would go into a booth, and he would talk into this carbon mic, and it would have this eerie, weird sound. And, of course, they had the regular square mics, like you're wearing the one you're wearing on your lapel. He has this cute pin here.
That's the RCA 44.
44, mic. Yeah. That's what they were using in those days. But I don't think that those mics were ever on in the audience. And it's true, you never heard a sound come out. I never thought of that.
Yeah,
you never heard a sound come out of the audience.
Yeah, because with the comedy shows, you would hear the audience. And I know they had to mic the audience in order to hear that.
Oh, sure.
But you would hear the audience constantly through the situation comedies or the big comedy
shows.
And I'll
tell you, I think they really asked the audiences to please be as quiet as you can. We're setting a very eerie mood here. And what could be worse than noise coming out when the Shadow is doing his who knows what evil lurks?
That's right. Paul, you were playing the organ for so many of these broadcasts. Now, when radio kind of came to an end, which was really, CBS was doing the last of radio into the very early 60s, 61 or so was when it just about folded
up. Ma Perkins was, I think, almost the last one to go off.
Yeah, Ma Perkins, one of the last. She went off the air on the day after Thanksgiving in 1960, and then CBS actually carried on with Suspense, Johnny Dollar, and Gunsmoke, and one or two others, just for a little bit.
It was more the evening show.
More years, yeah. Actually, they ended up feeding them on the network at a certain time, and then the stations could play them anytime they wanted. In fact, I believe WBBM in Chicago was playing into the 60s, Gunsmoke and Johnny Dollar, Sunday afternoons, because they were doing something else the rest of the week, you know.
Sure.
But now, then your career in broadcasting really kind of came to a close, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It came to a thud. Everybody felt it. You know, there's an interesting thing about that. The late Dick Liebert, who was the organist in the Radio City Music Hall, probably had, he had Our Gal Sunday, and he had When a Girl Marries, and he had Stella Dallas. And he was a man who liked to earn money. He was a very good businessman. The day the shows went off the air, he was coming down from Connecticut. He lived in Westport, and Rosa lived in Shelton. And she told me he tore his hair out in the train. He went into such a rage because he realized this was his last day of playing. It was a trauma. Many people, as Rosa said, she felt absolutely suicidal over it. When you're doing something, I was a latecomer. They'd been doing it since 1932. Mm-hmm. And when that came to an end, they could say, I did 20, 30 years of this. And I know Rosa, who was my dear friend, was simply horrified. Organists didn't know what to do. I think it was like the stockbrokers during 1929. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The average organist was making $1,000 a week back in the 50s and 60s. That's like $5,000-$6,000 today. Do you know what it's like to have $1,000 worth of work cut out right from under you?
Yeah.
Hard. For me, it was a little easier simply because I had many, many things I could fall back on. And oddly enough, because I had a few shows of my own, but because I was the leading substitute, it was easier for me to make the transition. But still, rock had replaced good music. Television had replaced radio. I felt displaced in 1960, and that's when I came to Chicago.
Well, we're glad you came to this place.
I'm glad I did, too.
And then, well, tell us about your career now. You've formed a company called Music Dynamics.
Right, and it came out of part of my radio work. What happened was, I was in an industry where you didn't have to read music in the afternoon shows. I mean, you played a theme that you knew like the back of your hand, and you could do bridges and segues and stings and all the stuff that you had to do.
There may be some people in our audience who don't know what you're saying when you're saying bridges and segues and stings.
Okay.
Regarding a radio show.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, a bridge is when you bridge from one scene to the next with da 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 da. And then you come in. A sting is when you da 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 dum. And all of a sudden you hear this big crashing chord, and out comes some great action. That's called a sting, you see. And a segue is, of course, as I say, from scene to scene. Now, we have another thing. And there's a term that your audience will find interesting. Many directors would say on a scene, don't match it, bridge it. You know what that meant? Many of us, you'd have action and we'd match the action with sound. Mm-hmm. And they'd say, don't match it, bridge it, which means go to the next scene. So we always had that. We always had either matching or bridging, and that was the basis of what we did to go from scene to scene.
If you were matching, what would you do?
The killer would say, you're dead, and you go, da-dum, two chords, da-dum. That would be to match it, you see? Or you would have absolute slush between two actors, and you would drone behind them or drone afterwards. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, if they said, don't match it, bridge it, you just go, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum, and you'd be into the next scene. I just wanted to pull right into the next scene.
Okay. All right, so now we're getting back to your...
My thing here. So I was not a good reader. I could do all the afternoon stuff. But when you put me with an orchestra for any reason at night, I was a bad reader, and it almost cost me a number of jobs that I had. In fact, it cost me a number of very good lucrative substitutions that I did. So one day I was really in trouble, and it was my good friend Buddy Weed, who was at ABC at the time, who kept complaining, you're not a good reader, you're working with orchestras, get your reading straightened out and get out of radio. And of course I was in recording, and many of the recording studios demanded, you know, first take, quick take, because in recording, the artist has got his royalties resting on how much studio time he's gotten. You had to be thorough pro. And I had reading problems. So I went to a lady named Ida Elkin in New York, who was really the patron saint of good reading. And she turned me into a good reader in a matter of about 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I was able to go back and re-audition, and I got on good footing with everybody, and I kept working for another 5 or 6 years until it all ended. But my career in this stuff, because once I got my feet wet in soaps, I was able to do some evening shows, and my career in nighttime radio almost came to the most abrupt end you ever saw, and I'd have kept that going. And I realized that there's a real need for the people to read, not only among the professionals, but among the non-professionals. So what I did was to start teaching at the institute where she was. And then when I came to Chicago, the now no longer existent Lion and Healy asked me if I wanted to come with them. They wanted to put new life blood into their 17 stores. And I came in as staff organist and head of teaching there. And it became an area where I was able to test out many of the things Ida had taught me and realized this kind of program learning, reading, because the way we do it, it's very much program learning without a lot of practice, because you can't program it and practice it at the same time. And I was able to try out ideas and learn that they worked and learn that they would do what I wanted them to do. And then when I left Lyon and Healy, I opened up my own company, called it Music Dynamics. And we specialize in piano and organ sight reading today, teaching people to read music who swore they could never read music before. And Ida's technique was pretty rudimentary, and I just added and added to that until I finally had it exactly the way I wanted it, much more sophisticated, much more high-tech. And today we process a couple hundred students every week through our studios who want to learn how to read music.
Now, these are not students who have no musical ability.
Some have, some haven't. We have them at every stage, Chuck. We have them at, we have professionals, we have non-professionals, we have church musicians, we have people at all levels. We do it for piano and we do it for organ. I have now incorporated voice because a lot of the commercials, people who do commercials in the city, can't read. And we've made it possible for them to read by extending this into their kind of a situation. And so we do it with them. There's another interesting story. Do you know that when all of this 8 and 16, 32, 64 tracks started coming in, the guys who produced the commercials in this town could write the music, but they couldn't read it back, and I'll never mention names on the air. They know who they are. I was flooded for a while with commercial people writing this stuff who could write it but couldn't do a you know, you had it for the mix down. You had to be able to read the mix down to get down to two tracks from 32 and 64. They couldn't read their own stuff. I had to show them how to do it. And that was another area. That brought me recognition among the professionals in this town. Because in New York, I had it, you know, through radio. Here, it was just through word of mouth. And now I teach as many professionals as I do non-professionals.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting career as well.
It is. Nothing will replace radio. I love that as much as you do. And you no one has the love you do of it, I think, except me in this town. But it'll never replace it. But it was a very rewarding thing, and I can always say that radio gave me the reason to do what I'm doing today. And that's kind of very heartwarming and fulfilling to me.
Well, that's nice. That's nice to say that there's a nice, warm relationship between what you're doing today.
And when I did that, radio. Oh, yeah.
We're going to talk lots more. We have some more clips, and we're going to be tuning into a little bit with Fibber McGee and Molly and Gail Gordon as Mayor La Trivia in just a couple of minutes. And later on, we've got a Dragnet show for you, too, and some other things. So you want to stick around for all of this. Paul Renard is our guest this evening. Paul, you have such a vast knowledge of the radio days in New York and a great recollection of those things. When you were an organist on one of the radio programs, what did you have to do? What was the scene? How did it work? You know, they said you're either going in as a substitute or this is your show or whatever. From the first moment that you got the assignment till you completed that assignment, what was the scene? What happened?
Well, the first thing you do if it's a morning show is you ask your answering service to call you. You set 3 clocks and you ask your mother to wake you up because you don't dare miss a morning show. And I used to just have the answering service. I'd have artist service call me and wake me up. That's first of all. When you get there, the first thing that you do, you pick up a script. You look at the script.
Now, you've not seen it before.
Seen it before. Okay. If you're smart, many organists didn't do it. I always read the script. I wanted to know everything going on. If you were smart, you saw the script. Many could do it just practically off the cuff, but I always like to make very sure. I started young there, about 18, and I wasn't about to not continue, so I thought I'd better be very well versed on what I'm doing. So I pick up the script and read it. Then once I read that, then I could see where the music bridges were coming in, and wherever that said sting, segue, match, bridge, under, fade, whatever it would be, I would do it. You would write that, and you circle that. You always circled your cues so you knew what was coming up. Then you would get to the point where they'd have the cold reading. And you were there. A lot of organists came in just in time to play, like, again, Bill Meter on that second show. But I was there, and I wanted to hear the cold reading. I wanted to know what was going on. So I'm there, and I'm listening to this cold reading. Now, with the cold reading, the director makes what's called cuts, which means the show is too long. The writer has now given us 18 minutes, and we need 13 minutes because you need 2 minutes for commercials. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was even 12 or 11. You really had to figure a two-minute commercial on each end. Now you've got to take 18 minutes and break it down to 11 minutes. How do you do it? You make cuts, and cuts means everything that you don't need to still keep the thing going. It's like editing. You know, what when you write an article, how many words can you take out and still know what you're talking about? So they'd cut scenes. Well, you have to be there, of course, for cuts, because you're making the cuts at the same time, which may rearrange how you're going to do your bridges and things. If you don't have a certain thing to do, then you may have to do something else. So you have to be very careful, and you sit in on these cuts with the director, and you know just what's happening there. He can be in the room with you, or he can be in the control room. He usually was in the room for the cold reading. Some directors did one thing, some did another. Then you had your dress. I mean, that's where it was at. And occasionally there were some directors who wanted to have a second reading through and then the final dress. But usually there's no time. Too many actors were too busy. Mm-hmm. So you did a cold, you did a dress. At the dress, you went...
Dress rehearsal.
Yeah. Right. You did a dress rehearsal. And that means... I'm glad you're stopping me, so I make sure your audience knows what I'm saying. These are all very common terms for me, but not for them. And so you'd have your dress rehearsal, and then everything would be in order, and then you'd get ready for your cue, and you'd be on the air. Now, there's a very interesting thing. When you would go on the air, we used to say we had two kinds of directors. The kind who could direct without looking at the clock. He could make a stretch as he would pull the hands apart to tell you to stretch it, or he would bring the hands together to tell you to go faster, or he'd put his finger on his nose, you're right on the nose, you're right on time. But there were two kinds of directors, the kind that would just simply know what to do, and the kind that had a stopwatch. Mm-hmm. And when you worked with a stopwatch director, you worked with what could be dull, because he would say, cut that. The most important things that would be punctuating the music. Many directors didn't really know the value of the music as much as the words. And they would cut out some of the most important things. And you'd hear a show, a playback, you know, in those days. And you would think to yourself, God, that was dull. I mean, if we had just done, but they didn't want that. And the director with the clock in his hand could make it very hard for us to really do a show, and actors felt very stultified by them. Mm-hmm. Musicians were just ready to die, because we were cut out before the words were, and many times we were cut out needlessly.
Would they sometimes substitute a musical bridge with just a little bit of silence?
A second or two
of silence to change the scene?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. But many times that don't bridge it. Don't match it, bridge it, was because he wasn't time to do a match. Because invariably, if you do a match, you may do a bridge unless you do a fade. That means you're just fading down. Mm-hmm. In other words, instead of matching the action, you're bridging it and taking it down to a fade. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll match it and then bridge it and then fade it.
What kind of time frame are we talking here between scenes, a matching or a bridging?
Bridging, it could be anywhere from 10 to 12 seconds. It could be 5 to 6 seconds. Those were so minuscule that most people don't realize that musicians really had quite a job to make sure that we didn't, because we could start taking the show and making it go longer and longer, and then it would give the actors problems. So you got very good, very fast at knowing that a match meant 3 seconds. It's easier to stretch a show than it is to speed it up when they're doing what they call heavy breathing love scenes. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to be responsible for that. And luckily, Rosa Rio had trained me well. Gene Perazzo, my other mentor in radio, had trained me well. And I knew what to do. When I went into it so young in my teens, with them helping me to get into this, I was very well trained, and I never did anything stupid, I can honestly say, on a radio show to my knowledge that I can remember.
Now, if they were running short, they would probably more than likely call on the musician, the organist, you, to stretch, right?
Then you would have your director look at you, and he would look at you, and he'd stretch, and I'd say, keep the music going. Mm-hmm. Keep the music going. If you ever listen to an old broadcast, do you have any of the When a Girl Marries Any? I know you have thousands of shows, but do you have any of the soap operas?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Listen sometimes when Dick Liebert is doing When a Girl Marries, when it was back at NBC, not when Rosa had it at ABC, but NBC. And somehow Tom McDermott, who was the director, always, it seemed to run shorter, and you'd hear Dick, I never knew quite whether he did this purposely or accidentally, would add music at the end, and he'd always put something there that ran probably around 20 to 30 seconds.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now, you had your own choice of music through one of these things?
Yeah,
if it says he wants a bridge, you can just make it up or use something, a stock thing that you have or something.
Whatever you want. If there's a new soap opera, the musician most often did not get the choice of what the theme was going to be.
I'm sure the theme was chosen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But when you got to the actual music itself, yes, I never had anybody write a bridge out for me. Of course, if you're doing a nighttime show or a crime thing like Crime Doctor or something like FBI or something like that, then your bridges are a part of the score of the show, and then you do that. As an organist, no one ever tells you what to play.
You know, sometimes I hear a comedy show and with an organ.
Mm-hmm.
It would be something like Archie Andrews or one of those.
George Wright did that in Leaf for years.
And the scene would end with Archie broke,
mm-hmm.
and was trying to find some money so he and Jughead could go out with Betty and Veronica,
sure.
or some silly thing like that.
Uh-huh.
And then the musical scene change would come in. You'd hear, "Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money," you know, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Now, that was the organist's choice.
Yes, and you have to understand how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Ann Leaf did that show, and then when she went to California, George Wright, who was NBC mm-hmm. staff, got that at that time. And if you ever hear the later George Wright, you know, he became very well known as a theater organist thousands of records.
Appeared at the Chicago
sure.
Theater many times.
Right.
At the Wurlitzer, huh?
Right. George has a sense of humor that is so off the wall. I mean, he's got a sarcasm that even matches Joan Alexander. He is funny, funny, funny. And it would be just like him to do that. He could actually match a song to a condition.
Mm-hmm.
If he walked in on the show cold, he could match it immediately. He has so many songs in his mind and
such
a fertile imagination. Rosa could do that very well. I learned to do it. You learn, get a song fast. But, of course, when you're rehearsing, those things will come to you, and sometimes you're doing. You have to say to the director, "How much time do I have? Can I throw in something that will match the predicament?"
Yeah.
And he'll either say yes or no. Ken McGregor, I think, was very generous with George. He got to do a lot of interesting things on Archie Andrews.
One last question before, because we want to tune into. Well, you're not going to go yet, but we want to listen to a Dragnet show.
Uh-huh.
You went from the moment you walked in
mm-hmm.
and got the script for the first time till the show went off the air.
Uh-huh.
That episode. Generally, how much time was that?
Okay. That usually ran, as a rule, about an hour before the show. They could usually do the whole rehearsal in about an hour. And when you had actors who had conflicts in lots of shows, if you had a director that took a long time to work, then the actor had to say many times, "I can't do it, I'll never make both shows."
Mm-hmm.
And actors did not want to do that. You see, it was a lot of actors in limited shows, just like organists. So, that was usually the way that mm-hmm. worked out.
I would assume sometimes you had established actors in the roles. They didn't really require an awful lot of rehearsal because they knew their character and they had been doing it for so long they could pick up the script.
Actors and musicians, if you stay with the show long enough, it becomes so automatic. Again, Bill Meader just walked in on Right to Happiness, I'm sure. Now, this is how they did that with those two shows. He rehearsed with Chick Vincent, who directed Pepper Young's Family. And I'm sure he rehearsed. I think it was Ernie Ricker who did the Right to Happiness. Mm-hmm. I used to know all the directors. But He had some rehearsal, but I'm sure he didn't get on the last rehearsal there, and he didn't need it. He played the show for 18 years. So when you did that, he could go from Pepper right on to Right to Happiness and have no problem and never miss anything. But everybody else usually had to have at least some kind of rehearsal right up, too. I never tried two conflicting shows.
Okay, so you were playing it safe. Huh?
I was not about to make a fool of myself. I always thought Bill was audacious, but he never missed.
Paul Renard, who has created the music dynamics and who created some wonderful musical sounds during those golden days of radio, is our guest this evening on our old-time radio nostalgia night here on Radio Classics. I'm Chuck Shaden. This is Chuck Shaden. We're listening to some good old radio shows, and we're talking about the good old days of radio. About the only thing I like as well as old-time radio shows is talking about those shows and those days with a man who, with anybody who knows a little bit about them. And Paul Renard knows a lot about the radio days. Paul, you have rubbed shoulders with a great many radio people.
Oh, yes.
Working out of New York.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you at one time worked with Goodman Ace and his wife.
Well, Jane. I wasn't on the early Easy Aces. I was too young for that. That was syndicated by Ziv years ago before they went into television when they were still doing radio shows. So that wasn't mine. But later on, they came to CBS directly, and they had a half-hour show called Mr. Ace and Jane.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, their announcer was Ken Roberts was their announcer then. I had that, but even that wasn't totally my show. It started out Fred Feibels. And then when Fred Feivel went to Florida, then I took over and did some of that. Mm-hmm. But that was fun, and I got to know Jane A., so I got to love. She was the most intelligent, you know, like Gracie Allen, you got to be pretty smart to play dumb.
That's
and
right.
She was
she was
lovely lady.
Mrs. Malaprop.
Malaprop, yes. Her, some of her lines were unbelievable.
She would say, "You could have knocked me over with a fender."
Right, exactly. Right. That was the best meal I ever put in my whole mouth. Yes, those are her lines. But she was a marvelous lady. Mm-hmm. She died at 72, as a matter mm-hmm. of fact. And then Goody just died a few years back. Mm-hmm. But
Goodman Ace was a tremendous writer.
Oh, yes. Did Milton Berle. Mm-hmm. I think he did an awful lot of shows. Berle was one of his big shows. Do you remember who the other one was? I used to know. Perry Como.
I think he wrote, yeah.
Did Como show, yeah. Mm-hmm. But when you met this man, you realize, like Fred Allen, he had that special kind of wit, dry as a martini, yeah, sharp as can be, and Jane was a wonderful foil for him. The difference, of course, I think that he did even less, in a sense, than George Burns did, because he was dry and slow, and Jane was always that kind of up cackly kind of cutesy birdie sound.
You know, I have to bring in an Easy Aces program to play here on Radio Classics some night, because we talk about it, and it just what's that appetite to hear that again. So I'll bring one in sometime. We can.
They were wonderful. Yeah. I got some old records mm-hmm. of some of the Easy Aces mm-hmm. shows, and you know, oddly enough, the organ that was used in those days was almost the very first Hammond that ever came out, the A organ. Whenever you hear that kind of sharp, the early Shadows had it. Mm-hmm. Whenever you hear that very, very sharp sound, that was even pre-Leslie speaker days, when that sound was almost as eerie as the program itself. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
I cannot discern between this type of an organ.
Now you'll go back and hear it, and you'll notice that in the later shows, it sounded like an organ, and oddly enough, some of them had almost that same sound, like a theremin. Mm-hmm. It was just very eerie, odd. Listen to your early Mysteries, and listen mm-hmm. to how strange the organ sounds. And that was even before my time. By the time I got there, it was a pretty different sound.
That's probably what helped send those shivers up and down your spine, listening to those.
When you listen to the early Shadows, mm-hmm. and you have lots of them, mm-hmm. go play one of your early Shadow programs. Play a later program after the Leslie speaker mm-hmm. came in, and you hear an eeriness in those early mm-hmm. programs that the later programs didn't have, because the organ sounded so strange.
That brings me to a question. Were the organs in the studio, were they wired into the console, into the sound system?
No.
They were picked up by the microphones?
Picked up by the mics. Uh-huh. Interesting thing about the way they did that. Organs and pianos, I know at NBC, were on dollies. Mm-hmm. And they were transferred. This was called setup. Mm-hmm. If I moved an organ 2 inches, I could get shot, because the unions wouldn't allow it. Yeah. So if I wanted an organ moved just within better view mm-hmm. of the director, I had to call setup, or someone mm-hmm. had to go and say, mm-hmm. Renard needs to be able to see. Send a setup man down. We've got mm-hmm. to move the dolly 2 inches. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm serious about this. Yeah. And that's the way they did that. But the organs were moved from studio to studio. The pianos were moved from studio to studio. CBS tend to leave their things there, because they didn't have as many studios. Mm-hmm. But when NBC was there, about 30 studios there, you were constantly moving something somewhere. So you always played an organ, always on a dolly. You were always mm-hmm. sitting on something there. You were never sitting on solid ground. I can't ever remember.
Elevated.
Always elevated, uh-huh. which wasn't bad, because you could see the director more easily, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you mentioned before, I think we were talking earlier about NBC and their setup at the Radio City, mm-hmm. at Radio City,
mm-hmm.
that they had a number of different organs there. How many organs would they have?
I estimate that NBC must have had about 23 Hammonds.
Oh, my God.
Mutual had probably about 14. CBS probably had, I would guess easily, mm-hmm. Maybe 15 or 16. Maybe not even quite that many. Maybe 14 or 15.
When you're playing the organ in a studio set up for mm-hmm. one of these a soap opera, mm-hmm. how far away from where you were with the organ were the actors and their microphones?
Give you an example. Mm-hmm. First would be the director in the booth. Mm-hmm. Then you would have over to the side the announcer, who might be just right over to the side. And then a little further forward, you'd have the actors on one or two mics. Mm-hmm. Behind that layered, you'd have the organist, and his speaker would be over maybe about 4 feet away, 5 feet away. Mm-hmm. And there'd be a mic right over the speaker. And that was how we were mic'd.
I see. And where was the sound effects man?
The sound effects man was usually over to the right or to the left.
Mm-hmm.
See, oddly enough, they were kind of given their own area, especially if they had to run around or do things like that. They had to have space. So they were always given space to work with. I had a couple of funny incidents. Many organists have, where the recorded sound effect didn't play, and they needed something. And one day they had a cricket that wasn't playing. So I grabbed a couple of drawbars that I thought would do it, and the guy's desperately looking. What am I going to do? And I start doing a little cricket there, and the cricket starts coming out of the organ, and they were able to segue into the Park murder scene there. Oddly enough, some years later, and I want to tell you this, when I was recording for Riverside Records, they had a thing called Offbeat Records, and Offbeat wanted to do unusual things. So in 1960, when radio went off, I kissed it goodbye by doing two albums of sound effects. Someday I'm going to play them for you. I still have them on the organ. On the organ, some theaters, some Hammond. But I just took everything that I knew and put it on two albums. Someday I want you to hear that.
Oh, love to hear that. Yeah, love to hear that.
That was my kiss goodbye to it all. And I'm glad I was... it was interesting that radio's chief substitute, as I say, I did some shows, but I was basically substituting, got... Instead of one of the people who was doing seven regular shows every day, I got to be the one who did the close-out and the kiss-out for it. And I always thought that was ironic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would see how that... You would feel that way about that. What was the determining factor? And I think I may even know the answer before I ask the question. But what was the determining factor when a producer would say, "I want an orchestra," or "I want an organist"?
There was a case where that happened. Mr. District Attorney started out with Peter Van Steeden's orchestra. Later, they went to Charles Paul. And Charles Paul became the organist for that show. It was very simple. Economics.
That was the basic.
The economics is the only thing that would ever take an orchestra off a show because the orchestra lent prestige. You never heard an organ on Cavalcade of America, and you never heard an organ on Lux Radio Theater.
No.
The prestigious factor was there. And Mr. D.A. had Van Steeden for years. You probably know because you have a good collection of that, too. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I even filled in for Charles on that
and
thing.
It shall be my duty as district attorney.
Right. And that came from the third floor at NBC. That was one of the... There were two large third floor studios. One, by the way, was later converted to Howdy Doody. And then I did Rudy Kazuti, which was a local thing in New York. I was the organist for Rudy Kazuti. Again, I was second organist. Gene had that, and then after he left, I did that. And then when I left, Milton Kay did it. So many of us did these things. But Rudy came from 3B, and Howdy Doody came from 3A.
Did you do much work for television?
No. My television career was limited. I've done a lot of television things in conjunction with Music Dynamics. When Bill Meader was doing Search for Tomorrow... They made a deal with Procter & Gamble. You know, they were in Cincinnati, Procter & Gamble, and, of course, so was the Baldwin Company in Cincinnati. And so they made some arrangement where he had to use a Baldwin organ there, and at that time I was doing a lot of work for the Baldwin Company, concerts and things. So I came in, and I did Search for Tomorrow so Bill could find out what was going on with this instrument here. That was so that he literally could observe where we were coming from. Then when a couple of times when he had a couple of these epileptic fits, I filled in. He was an epileptic. He's gone now. And when he'd have these, and I would go in and I would play it for him. In fact, I did some of his other shows when he would be ill. He was ill most of his life. He did Big Sister. He did Pepper Young and I Said Right to Happiness. He had a lot of shows. And so therefore, we were good friends, and I got to do some of his things and then later the Search for Tomorrow. But TV was not my big thing. And I wasn't there long enough because, remember, I left New York in 61 to come out here, and from 61 until the 70s is when TV really shot up big and color came in and all of that came in. So I wasn't even there.
Well, I'm glad you were there when you were there.
I am glad I was, too.
You've offered me at least a new perspective on those radio days, because I've talked to writers and to performers and to producers and directors, but seldom have we spoken with musicians. And point of view from being a studio organist in those days adds a different light to all of these things.
We see it from a completely different basis. See, there's an interesting thing about my position. Most of these organists started out in theaters and silent films. Lou White, Dick Liebert, all of them played the silent films. Jesse Crawford, Rosa, all of them were in with the silent films. I came in a very much a Johnny come lately in the 50s, then, you know, in my teens and early 20s. And it was audacious. I don't think I could have even learned enough about it, but for Rosa and for Gene, who simply taught me radio. I'm probably the only person in the history of radio that was taught radio by two radio people because I hadn't experienced playing that stuff in theaters. I think that's awfully interesting now that I think about
it. You know, it is. And if you had been around in the very early days of radio, you would have had probably many half-hour programs of your own because that was one of the staples of the early radio days. They'd put an organist in front of the microphone, and they'd play for a half an hour.
Right.
And
there
was not much on the air in those days.
Right, but you know, there's another factor. Are you aware of the standby thing? I'm sure you are.
Mm-hmm.
We had in New York, for years, you never knew if California might go out.
Mm-hmm.
When we had a California show, you had an organist in the studio. In case California went out, you were filling in. And so every staff organist at one point or another served his time sitting in the studio for a show like Art Linkletter's House Party, mm-hmm. and things like that, which was NBC. And I remember seeing Fred Feibel one day when he was at NBC. He was just sitting there doing. I said, "What are you reading the paper for?" He says, "I'm on a standby for Art Linkletter." But until in mm-hmm. those days, you had standby organists sitting there making a living just reading the newspaper in case they went out.
If California went out, it means the line went down or something.
Right. What do you do to fill that in or something? Well, so they always had an organist sitting there to play.
Was that a union requirement? Why wouldn't they just put a record on or something?
Because the union requirement was. Getting a record on was a trick. You remember what Petrillo did years ago with a recording. When you live, the unions don't have quite the power they did with that. They don't have the need for it either today either. But where that stuff was concerned in New York, because there's no reason for them to. But the unions governed us. Mm-hmm. They told us what we could do, how many shows we could play, what shows we could play. Blessedly, you couldn't have two staff jobs. If you freelanced, you could work all you wanted to. There was never a problem. And there were weeks when I did as much freelance stuff and sub stuff mm-hmm. as anybody could do in a week. I said to Rosa one day, I said, "You're doing 30 shows a week. I think I did 30 shows this week. There may have been 30 different shows. You did the same six, five times mm-hmm. across the board." Mm-hmm. I didn't. Across the board means 5 days
yes,
a week.
Uh-huh.
But I got to keep remembering that. You have to translate this. And but I must have done as many shows as you did this week. Rose and I still talk occasionally now. We still talk about the golden days of radio. Mm-hmm. I asked Rose if she misses it. She says, "No." She says, "I'll always miss it, but now it's been 30 years, you know,
mm-hmm.
or 29, 28 years now." But I don't think it's totally true. I think you are so blessed, the way you love radio and all this, that you have the exposure that the rest of us don't have the exposure in creating it. But you have the exposure in pushing it and keeping it in front of the public. And I want to say this to your listeners. I think it's wonderful, Chuck, that you do this.
Oh,
I think it's
you.
The most wonderful
mm-hmm.
thing because the youngsters get to know what we had and what we did. I think, really, I can't tell you how much I enjoy your shows, how much I know everyone else does, and how much I think it means to all of us to know that you're keeping what we did alive. I every mm-hmm. once in a while hear you do a show of yours, and I know I'm on it, and I can recognize just because my playing's a little different. And it really, I can't tell you, I get cold chills when I hear it.
Glad you did those shows, and that we have them, that we can share them. I want to take a second on this, but I got into all of this stuff because I started a collection of radio shows,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to share that collection.
Mm-hmm.
I can only go so far dragging people into the living room
uh-huh.
and saying, "Sit down and listen to this tape," you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought the logical thing is to go on the radio with it.
Mm-hmm.
We've been very, very lucky to be able to do that.
And your enthusiasm is infectious. Mm-hmm. You love as much presenting it to the world as I think we did creating it. And I think you've done the radio industry a great service. I think all of us that were in it are very grateful to you for doing that, that you're doing it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Paul Renard is our guest this evening on our old-time radio classics. It's been a joy to have you with us. Now, Paul, one last thing on,
mm-hmm.
on music dynamics.
Uh-huh.
Someone who wants to improve their reading
right.
of music ability will come to you, right?
Right. People who are interested in learning to read music for the piano or for the organ, who have given up on it, who have many, many problems, you know, with it. Incidentally, we've renamed the company, just like Evelyn Wood. I now call it Paul Renard's Music Dynamics. So that's, why I think, the way we're even listed. It's listed, I think, maybe both ways, but that's the way what we call it today. I just finally decided to put my name in the signature.
Top billing.
No, it's my thing, and it took me years to get enough ego to do that, but I did. And in it, what we do is we take people who may have learned piano or didn't learn piano or wanted to learn piano or organ, and there's many organs sitting around gathering dust because they really weren't mm-hmm. sold very fairly mm-hmm. to the public, and they're very much out of it now. But many people have, I say, instruments gathering dust in their living rooms, and we say to them, call us and we'll teach you to learn to read music. And this, as I say, it all came out of my need to do it, and we try to give that to the public today.
Okay, hang on just a second. We don't want you to go away before we say goodbye, and we've got to do a little bit of business. Chuck Shaden here. We're about a minute and a half away from having to say goodbye. Paul Renard, I can't thank you enough for joining us tonight.
And this hasn't just been a pleasure. It's been a joy. I've been waiting to do it for a long time.
Well, we're real happy that you came along. Wish you success, continued success with Paul Renard's Music Dynamics. And thank you for all the good work you did in the good old days of radio. You helped make them good.
And thank you for keeping it going.
We're glad to do that, too.